Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Brought to you by BAE Systems. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DOD this week. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us as we begin a special edition of the program this week, continuing our coverage of the Army's Big Week, the annual Association of the U.S. Army Conference here in Washington, AUSA, as it's usually called. You've heard several of the Army's top leaders on our air during the course of this conference. In this hour, we're going to hear from four top general officers on four different topics, though some common threads run through them: sequestration, the Army drawdown, and the government shutdown. Later in the hour, we'll hear from General Ray Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Bill Phillips, the Army's top uniformed acquisition officer, and General Donald Campbell, the commander of U.S. Army Europe. We start the hour, though, on the topic of personnel. Lieutenant General Howard Bromberg is the Army's G1, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel. We start with his assessment of the current balance of the Army's uniformed force.
Right now, in the overall shape of the drawdown force, we're pretty much manned pretty well across the force. We have some emerging skills that we need to develop, cyber skills would be one example. But right now, we're about 530,000 of where we ended the year at, and, of course, we're on our way to 490,000 by the end of FY15. So our pace is about 20,000 a year. With about 20,000 a year being reduced, we maintain readiness across the force, and that's our yardstick to make sure we don't break the Army as we're taking the Army down.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, are all your plans and all your execution on the drawdown still based on that 490 assumption, or are you looking at possibly going lower at this point?
Everything we're doing today is based upon 490, but we have got plans on the shelf for if we went to 480, 470, 460, because we just got to be prepared to do it. And everything we're trying to do today, we got to keep an eye to the future. So we're trying to balance today's conditions. What we don't want to do is create undue risk by drawing down too fast before we know where we're going to actually end up.
Right. So talk me through what you think some of the challenges and potential pitfalls are as you execute the drawdown.
I think my number one concern is, of course, you know, we reduce the sessions, bring in fewer soldiers every year to ensure that we help reduce numbers that way. So in that area, what I'm concerned about, what are the market conditions that change in America today that could make recruiting more difficult as we draw down? I don't want to reduce the sessions too far down and then find out I also have a recruiting problem at the same time, and then I don't meet the recruiting goals. So I think that's my number one concern. Tied to that equally, I'd say two number one concerns is, you know, this is an extremely high quality Army. And so I want to make sure that everybody understands that this isn't about reducing the Army by eliminating poor performers. This is about, unfortunately, having to take a very, very high quality force, and not everybody's going to be able to stay in the Army. And I think that's my second concern. Equal with the recruiting is to make sure everybody understands this is a high quality force, and you've got to treat this very carefully as we draw down.
Those are difficult decisions to get rid of people you really don't want to get rid of. What are some of the pathways to hold on to them in some capacity in the RC, et cetera?
Well, we will, for example, for those soldiers that do leave the active component, very aggressive offering them opportunities in the reserve component. United States Army Reserve Command and National Guard both. We have a shortage of company-grade officers and NCOs in the reserves, for example, so we have excesses someone could transfer into the reserves. But the other thing I think we have to do with this force is treat them with absolute transparency, so they know far enough out in advance what is potentially going to happen to their year group or their MOS or their skill set. In other words, let's not have any last-minute notices. Let's tell people very far in advance. For example, on the Selective Early Retirement Board, we did that with formal counseling, which we'll do in all the future boards as well. And then we give more than a year's notice, which I think is a pretty good thing. In other words, we're just not going to pull the string on and say, oh, tomorrow morning we're going to have a board. Very, very open and transparent across the force.
So talk to me about some more of the mechanisms that you're using to actually execute the drawdown.
Okay.
And have you been able to successfully get those departures to happen voluntarily with the means that you've used so far?
Well, let me go back. We're not doing voluntary separations.
Okay.
All our separations at this point, I would say, are in the involuntary category. So, for example, I already talked about reduced accessions. We're limiting those who can come in the Army by reducing the accessions. We're doing qualitative selections of non-commissioned officers and MOSs that are overstrength at all grades of NCO. So if your MOS has too many people in it, we are holding a board, reviewing those performance files, and then those people are asked to leave that don't meet the cut there. The same thing will happen on the officer side as well. We'll do reduction boards to go ahead and evaluate officers based upon certain year groups, skills, and where they sit within the military, and then we'll go ahead and ask some of those officers to have to leave as well. Additionally, we're closing MOSs for reenlistment. So you might be a truck driver and you might want to reenlist, but if we have too many truck drivers, you just can't reenlist as a truck driver. You might be able to reenlist in another skill set, or you might just have to leave the service if there's no room for you. Mm-hmm.
It seems like whenever any of the Army senior leadership goes on the road and talks to soldiers, the first, maybe even the second and third question are about budget, fiscal mm-hmm. matters. You mentioned the economy being a potential impact to Sessions in the future. Do you foresee a point possibly in the near future where the uncertainty of the budget is so overwhelming that people who would have otherwise wanted to come in say, I don't think so?
I don't think that will affect us. What I get concerned about is any changes in unemployment in America. If the unemployment rate drops significantly, it does have an impact on how we recruit, because it gives those people more options that are graduating from high school and from college and so forth. So we have to watch that, particularly in some of the skill sets that we might be looking at. I mentioned cyber earlier. Mm-hmm. If there's a big demand in the IT community outside the military, people will go to the IT industry, where we want to try to pull for that high talent from that in the Army. So we just have to watch that balance very, very carefully. I don't need the budget, because our pay has always been fenced and our benefits are really pretty good.
Right.
And compared to the civilian sector, we do have excellent benefits, excellent pay when you match us with the military. So I think it's still going to be a place of choice, but when there's more choice, then it's competition. And we just have to fight that competition.
All right. Let me broaden out that last question just slightly and just ask you to assess the overall morale of the uniformed force right now, given the budget. Is it having an impact?
I don't think the budget has negatively impacted morale of the uniformed service member today, because really we haven't been affected like our civilians have been. We haven't been furloughed. We haven't had to stay home without pay and those kind of things. Where I do think we'll start to see some change, it depends how well people handle it, is on our post camps and stations, as the money gets tighter with Installation Management Command, as we start prioritizing those services we've had before. You'll still get the service, but maybe it's not open as many hours a day. So I think that place, I don't think the morale's impacted yet, but I think people are watching very closely.
Final thing, the shutdown is still fresh in people's minds. Did that have any either temporary or long-term impacts on the uniformed force that you would point to?
It absolutely had a temporary impact. It was very painful for us. For example, we had a challenge I know you heard about where, because we didn't have any money, we weren't allowed to pay death gratuity to those families of our fallen. We got that fixed. We had an executive order, but we went through a time period there. It was very difficult. That was just one example. There are other things that affect us. We couldn't hold promotion boards because we didn't have the money to pay TDY for people to sit the promotion boards. So that had a temporary effect because now we're behind in the board schedule. Our goal is no one's going to get disadvantages in the force today, but we're just going to have to churn harder to catch back up now. That was most of the impact for us. It's just delaying things that we need to stay on schedule for, that now we'll just have to just work twice as hard to catch up. But I don't see any long-term impacts to the military member at this point.
That's Lieutenant General Howard Bromberg, the Army G1, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel. We'll take our first break, and when we come back, a look at what's happening in Europe with the Army's top commander there. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. As we get back to some more of our conversations with the Army senior leadership, interviews we recorded at the annual Association of the U.S. Army Conference here in Washington. Later in the hour, we'll hear from the very top of the Army Officer Corps, General Ray Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff. In this section of the show, though, a focus on Europe. General Donald Campbell is the commanding general of U.S. Army Europe. He assumed command in January of this year. He talked with me about some of the top priorities he's developed in the months since.
There are a number of things that we're doing. The Chief of Staff of the Army, when I took command, gave me a few missions, and I would characterize the two most important is continue to work with EUCOM as we build for the future, European Command, as we build for the future, you know, post-ISAF. From a con plan standpoint, from a readiness standpoint, interoperability standpoint. And then he said, I want you to become more interoperable with NATO. And I think it's all linked inextricably. So inside of that interoperability with NATO and really EUCOM, is make the Joint Multinational Training Command down at Grafenwehr-Hohenfels more multinational. As multinational as it is, 40% this fiscal year, last 2013, it'll be even more this fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the context of what I was told to do. From a strategic standpoint, looking to the future, you know, we've gone from 213,000 at the height of the Cold War, but 89, to 32,000 going to 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
So my mission has been to continue to transform the command, obviously to make it more leaner, and I would say more agile, and to give it a capability for the future that makes sure that the units that are there are combat ready, mission ready, and that we can continue to do the theater security cooperation mission, which is so important in Europe. 51 nations, and we're dialoguing with virtually all of them. I've been to a good part of Eastern Europe in the 10 months I've been in command. I've been to Russia, Bulgaria, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. So working with all those nations that have, in the past 20 years, came out from behind the Iron Wall, the Cold War era. So a lot of work in that arena to continue to make sure that we maintain a forward presence that is viable, that is set for the future, to give the nation and certainly the Army all the range of options that in a command that supports really three geographic combatant commands, EUCOM, AFRICOM, and CENTCOM.
And that increased emphasis on interoperability with NATO and other European partner nations, is that kind of a piece with the decreased commitment of U.S. forces in Europe, sort of them taking on more responsibility for
regional
security?
Well, sure, we're always looking to build capacity with our European and our NATO allies. But it's to continue to find a way post-ISAF, because, you know, a good number of the European nations, NATO and non-NATO, have contributed to the ISAF mission in Afghanistan. So working to stay connected with them for the future and helping them build capacity. And I've been very impressed with the nations that I've built with, and that's a lot of them, that, you know, previously we really didn't have a relationship before the wall came down. Their ability to support, if you look at Poland, I mean, just one in general, big supporter. Romania, smaller country, big supporter in Afghanistan, and I could name many more. But and then continue the dialogue with our partners that we've been so steadfast with, the UK, French, Germans, and others, through the NATO process, integration and process. So, yeah, it's a part of it, and we want to continue to build on that and work with as many other nations as we can.
I'm sure you get asked this a dozen times a day, but in the specific context of the rebalance to the Asia-Pacific, what, in your view, is the role slash relevance of Army forces in Europe?
Well, I always use the term, you know, request for forces. And I tell folks that you cannot, so I'll abbreviate it, RFF. You cannot RFF trust. So our ability to have 30,000 forward deployed troops in Europe to continue to be ready for mission sets, to, you know, my doctrinal mission, our doctrinal mission in USER, is to open a theater. We wouldn't be able to do that if we're not there, especially with the units that we have from the theater, you know, the Theater Sustainment Command, the 21st, that has that very important mission. And then just the continued relationship building that we do all the time. We clearly acknowledge, I do, and USER does, that we have rebalanced to the Pacific from a national security strategy standpoint. We support that, obviously. The thing that we want to do is continue to make sure that everybody knows that Europe remains relevant. The Vice President said it better than I, you know. We view our engagement with the rest of the world through the European eyes. We're going to deal with Europe when we deal with, you know, worldwide problems, and I think that will remain the case.
Mm-hmm. Say a little bit more about the drawdown from Europe, if you would. And maybe drawdown is not the proper term, but I think you're going from about 40,000 to 30,000 over the next few years.
Yeah.
How's that process going? How's it going to generally change the footprint of the Army?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, I alluded to 213,000 about 1989. Mm-hmm. We're in about the mid-30s, lower 30s now, going to 30. It'll be more leaner, more agile. Two brigade combat teams, a combat aviation brigade. The 21st Theater Sustainment Command, a two-star headquarters. We'll continue to put a general officer down at Joint Multinational Training Command. And we'll go from, at the height of the Cold War, 850, really, locations, to about seven major garrisons and about 125 sites.
Mm-hmm.
Which will give us the ability to continue to touch and train and partner with our European allies. Those seven sites are, you know, one in Vicenza, one in the Benelux, and then five in Germany that will allow us to continue to train our troops and provide for theater security. And, you know, Mission Command will be centralized in Wiesbaden, our new headquarters. Sustainment Hub down in Kaiserslautern with the 21st Theater Sustainment Command. And our training area, Grafenwehr-Hohenfels, so we get that linkage.
That reduction in basing is interesting. You know, whenever the subject of base realignment and closure comes back here in the U.S., BRAC, you know, critics tend to say things like, well, the military needs to be closing bases in Europe instead. Sounds like you're doing quite a bit of that already.
Well, we already are, and I would argue you're getting the American public is getting a good bang for the buck with what we will have left in Europe at the end of the day. We're gaining efficiencies. We're learning a lot. We're consolidating. We're working with EUCOM. We're working with the Department of Defense and the Department of the Army to continue to consolidate and look for ways to find efficiencies. We're doing more joint exercises with the Air Force, Navy, and the Marines. I mean, every time I get an opportunity, I'm looking to do something joint, because those will help bring dollars to the exercise program when you can combine and do more joint and multi-national and coalition.
Including mainly joint basing, or the seven garrisons you mentioned mostly?
Well, seven garrisons, you know, will be primarily Army-centric, with the exception of the Benelux garrison, which obviously supports mostly NATO, and then the Stuttgart garrison, which supports AFRICOM and EUCOM. Those are our two. The others, when you have Kaiserslautern, Wiesbaden, or what we call now U.S. Army Garrison Rhineland-Pfalz, U.S. Army Garrison Bavaria, U.S. Army Garrison Wiesbaden, and then you have Ansbach. So those primarily, but linked in with the Air Force, you know, and Kaiserslautern, we're right next to Ramstein, so mm-hmm. we do a lot of business with our Air Force partners there.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about government shutdown, just because it's kind of top of mind right now. I mean, we all kind of know what the effects were back here. What did it kind of look like in Europe?
Well, I would say it was pretty similar. It was painful. Mm. It was tough to look our great Army civilians in the eye and say, you know, take another one for the team, when they took 6 weeks off. They were directed to take 6 furlough days this past fiscal year. We worked through it. We continue to tell our great Army civilians what they bring to the team, and to, you know, continue to stay with us. I think the fundamental thing that the Army could use, and the Chief of Staff has reiterated it multiple times, is we need a budget. The Army needs a budget that they can depend upon. You know, the Chief has not had a budget in the 2 years he's been the Chief. He's had continuing resolutions. The Secretary, pretty similar. So the Army needs a budget to continue to be able to focus and say, here's your budget for the future, good or bad. And we know that we're going to have to be part of the solution when it comes to making the tough choices. But having a budget would make life much, I wouldn't say simpler, but easier for the Army as it would go forward, because it could make the decisions it needs to make.
Mm-hmm. Let's wind it back where we started. You opened talking about some of your big, broad strategic priorities. What's top of mind for you in the next year or two in managing Army Forces Europe?
Well, we're going to continue to make sure that we support, you know, the Chief of Staff and his objectives. You know, he's coming out with I think, Waypoint 2, and he'll probably talk about it a little later today from his strategic priorities. And then we're going to continue to be part of the solution when it comes to the prevention of sexual assault and sexual harassment. That's a big thing on our mind right now. It's on the Chief's mind, and we want to make sure that we're doing all we can as commanders. And that's why we think that it's very important commanders maintain and stay in the process of UCMJ, whether it's related to Article 20 offenses or anything else. And so it's been a very successful run with the UCMJ, and we think it'll continue to be. So we're going to continue to focus on the Chief's priorities, which is the prevention of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and to make sure that we continue to do our part to make sure we maintain ready, trained forces and do all the theater security cooperation that we can do in Europe with the money that we're provided, and give the American public the biggest bang for their buck.
All right, sir. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
General Donald Campbell is the commander of U.S. Army Europe. After another break, we'll continue our coverage of the annual AUSA conference, including a view from the very top. General Ray Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff, joins us when we come back. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Servius. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. As we get back into our conversations with top Army leaders during our visit to the annual Association of the U.S. Army Conference here in Washington. And you can't go any higher than our next guest, General Ray Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff. He talked to us about a new list of priorities he outlined during the conference. But first, his view on the latest turns in Washington's ongoing budget turmoil.
General Odierno, thanks very much for stopping by and giving us some time this morning.
Glad to be here.
And so let's start with some very near-term stuff. You know, the shutdown is still very much on everyone's minds, and hopefully it didn't do any long-term damage to the Army. But I know there were many, many, many short-term effects. I know it's just the latest instance of Washington dysfunction that you're kind of living through. But beyond the stuff that made the headlines, like the suspension of death benefits, walk us through sort of an after-action of what that did.
Well, the problem I see with sequestration is this continuing impact it has on our civilian employees, our Department of the Army civilian employees, who just went through at the end of last year 6 days of furlough, potentially was high as 12, and then we shut down and locked them out. So it's this uncertainty that I worry about for our workforce. They're so important to everything we do, and it's important for them to understand that we need them and that they have a job that is something that they can depend on, and these constant shutdowns and other things affects them. So I think in the long term, it's the impact on our civilian workforce. We need them. They're so critical to everything we do, and I worry now that we have to go through this again in January, potentially. Hopefully we won't. Hopefully we'll get that figured out. But there's all this uncertainty that remains surrounding our workforce.
So the point is, it's not just one event. It's a sort of a cascading, cumulative effect.
It is. And then, you know, in terms of budget issues, you add the shutdown to continuing resolutions. I've been the Chief of Staff of the Army for just over 2 years. We've had 13 continuing resolutions.
Yeah.
So that's a predictability problem for us. And if you don't have predictability, then you can't manage your programs properly. And so we're hoping that we can get through all of this. And then a shutdown is part of that, as you continuing resolution, shutdown, continuing resolution,
yeah,
et cetera.
I mean, take me into some more of the specifics, if you could, on that. I mean, what are the effects of not having that predictability?
Well, the bottom line is, you know, you submit a budget. You work very hard with Congress into building a budget for the Army, which we think is the best budget, the best use of the dollars we have available. And then when it doesn't get passed and you go to a continuing resolution, then it doesn't match up with your priorities. And then what happens, you get wasteful because you can't necessarily let new contracts under a continuing resolution. You can't do things that might help you to start moving forward, even with reduced budget levels. And so what happens is you become more wasteful and you're not getting everything you need for your money. And so for me, that's really problematic, especially during these times of budget reductions.
To you, what are some of the – there were lots of bad effects in 2013, which is now over. To you, what were some of the worst effects of this?
Well, the bottom line is we had a continuing resolution, plus you added sequestration on it over the last 6 months. So we had to really cut down on our readiness training. We had to stop training. We couldn't invest in sustaining our equipment at the right level. And so what happens is that now cascades into 14. And if we go to a continuing resolution plus sequestration, that will then cascade into. So you're getting further and further and further behind, and so then it takes you longer to dig out of this problem. And, you know, I don't want to spend too much time, but the problem we've had all along with sequestration, whether we agree with the amount or not, that's one issue, but it's the execution of it. It's all up front. And when you want to take so much money out up front, you're limited in what you can do. And so we have to really hit readiness and modernization of our Army in order to meet the requirements of sequestration. So if we could backload it a bit, it would help us to better plan for it and come up with a better solution at the same budget level.
Mm-hmm. To that readiness point, you said at the press conference yesterday with the Secretary that there are now only 2 brigades that are fully trained and ready to deploy. The expression on your face as you said that was somewhere between dismay or at least severe disappointment. You also described sort of a get-well plan as we go into 2014. How's that going to work?
What we're planning on doing is we're assuming a continuing resolution with sequestration. So that's worst case.
Yeah.
So with worst case, we're going to have to go to some level of fencing a part of the force that we're going to train full up. And so we're fencing around 7 brigades plus all the associated enablers and support capability that goes with those brigades. And we're going to try to get them trained. We hope to have that done by June of 2014. The problem with that is, so there'll be, if we're able to do that, we'll get them trained and ready. Because my biggest fear is we have to ask to send some people somewhere and they're not properly prepared. But what that means is the rest of the force is going to be training at very, very low levels because there's just not going to be much money for them. And that's a problem for us. But that's we have to do this because we don't know when we might be asked to use the Army because of the uncertainty in the world today.
Mm-hmm. As you draw down that force, describe to me some of the challenges that you have. I talked to your G1 yesterday, and he just really emphasized the force that we have now is really high quality, and there's very few people we want to get rid of.
Yeah, well, so what we've done is, you know, we were at a high of 570. Today we're at about 530.
Mm-hmm.
We're on our way down to 490. Could go lower than that. We're still working through that. But what that means is so far we've been able to, we want to keep all our quality. Well, we're at the point now where we're at quality. And so we're now going to have to conduct boards that pick who leaves and who stays. And you now what you're doing is anybody you leave now is quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody who has lots of experience, who's trained, who's prepared. And this includes our officers and our non-commissioned officers. And so that's going to have an impact. And we're going to reduce civilians as well. We're going to be forced to do a long-term reduction in our civilian workforce as well. So that'll be a riff. And so we're now going after the quality. And so it's tough. These are people who have dedicated themselves to our country, dedicated themselves to the mission. And it's not because they're not doing their job well. It's just that we're getting smaller.
Mm-hmm. You said, I think, in 14, you're assuming sequestration. Does that mean you need to plan to go below 490 or accelerate this drawdown?
Well, the bottom line is originally our original plan was we're going to go to 490 by 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So if we assume sequestration, we're going to have to speed that up and get to 490 by the end of 15. We've already announced that we're eliminating brigade combat teams. That will speed up till the end of 15. And then based on what happens in the budget, we'll have to decide what happens after that. But if we continue with sequestration, it's going to go lower than that, significantly lower. And that will happen over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years after that. So if we execute full sequestration, the Army will be reducing end strength between now all the way to 2019 probably. And we'll have to reduce both the active and reserve component end strength.
I've asked you a lot of gloom and doom questions, for which I'm sorry, but as you said yesterday, you're looking forward because you got to. So what are you looking at? What are your priorities?
Well, I think, you know, it's important. You know, we've talked a lot about budget, but I have to make sure the Army gets focused on where we're going. So as I look to the complex world that we're in and the potential missions that we might have to accomplish, we've set about five priorities. One is, first, is developing adaptive leaders. And what does that mean? Well, we're looking at all of our leadership programs from the United States Military Academy to our ROTC to the Army War College, the Command and General Staff College, to our NCO courses, and we're reworking those in order to ensure we are developing leaders that can operate in a future environment, complex environment. And it's about critical thinking. It's about many other things as well. And it's also about broadening and managing talent underneath that. We think we have to be a globally responsive, regionally engaged Army. So what does that mean? That means that we have to make sure that we're set up to respond in small elements up to large elements to meet our nation's needs. We're going to have units that are aligned to our combatant commands, whether it be in the Middle East or the Pacific or South America or anywhere else, and they will be able to understand and learn the socioeconomic, cultural issues. They'll be involved in training and helping foreign armies. They'll be involved in deployments. And then next is obviously make sure we sustain our readiness and modernization levels and that we have an army that is well-trained. We have our combat training centers that are in the California desert and in Louisiana and in Europe, actually. And we're going to refocus to make sure that we're sustaining and investing in those so we can certify our units and make sure they are prepared for this complex environment that we see. And then we're focusing on the profession of arms. You know, the Army is our bedrock of the Army is trust. And it's important that we never walk away from our profession and what that means, that we represent the United States of America, the moral and ethical values of this country, that we have to maintain a significant level of inherent trust between soldiers and leaders, and trust between the Army and the American public. And we have to constantly ensure that we don't ever lose that trust. And then finally, is we have to sustain the premier all-volunteer Army. And we have to make sure that we have the right army that will allow us to continue forward, both in, with civilians and military leaders who are able to take us forward, and that we can take care of our people and make sure that they get what they deserve for the sacrifices they make to defend this country.
Earlier this morning, Sergeant Major Chandler chastised me for using the phrase garrison force. His point was, and as you said, you want to be regionally engaged around the world. Yeah. Is that somewhat dependent on funding, or to you, is that a must?
We will build that within the budget. It's something that is critical. You know, what I talk about is the reason we have an army is to prevent conflict, is to shape the areas of operation in the different regions of the world. Then only if necessary do we use our forces to win if we have to fight a war. And so for us, understanding our ability to prevent conflict, to shape areas of the world that allows us and our allies to be successful so we don't have to fight and win. Now, we have to have the capability to do all three of those. And so now we're going into a time where we're involved with preventing conflict and then shaping conflict for the future, and that's what we have to focus on.
Well, General Odierno, it's been a real pleasure having you with us this morning. Thanks so much for stopping
Thank
by.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, very much.
General Ray Odierno is the Army Chief of Staff. He talked to us at the Association of the U.S. Army's annual conference here in Washington, as did all our other guests this hour. We'll hear from one more after our final break this hour, Lieutenant General Bill Phillips, Principal Military Deputy to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment this hour from our visit to this year's Association of the U.S. Army Conference here in Washington, where we had a chance to visit with several of the Army's senior leaders. You heard from General Ray Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff, before the break. We wrap up the hour with a focus on Army modernization, though. Lieutenant General Bill Phillips is the Principal Military Deputy to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, and the Chief of the Army Acquisition Corps.
The focused S&T effort, science and technology, that's related to the 30-year strategy is so critical for our Army. As we look at reduction in essentially procurement funds that fund programs going forward in the next several years, what we have to make sure that we do is to have science and technology investment for the innovative ideas that our Army is going to require in 2020 and beyond. So the focused 30-year strategy that Ms. Hsu has us executing today is going to lead to the Army of the future and future technologies that will enable our soldiers to be successful on the field of battle.
And, but again, how much trouble has that run into this year as we've had fits and starts with appropriations bills and the absence thereof?
Well, Jared, I have to be honest with you. What has been really troubling for us and for the Army as a whole has been the budget uncertainty and how the uncertainty of sequestration and continuing resolutions, how that has impacted our programs and our budgets going forward. It has impacted every program that we manage, and we manage well over up to 1,000 programs. And each one of them in some way has been impacted by the budget, the uncertainties of the budget going forward. And we've had to adjust to that. In some cases, we've had to adjust schedules or adjust timelines for delivering capability. And that certainly is not effective and efficient in delivering capabilities to soldiers. It impacts what we can do. What we really need today, in my view, is certainty in our budget and the dollars that we get today to execute our mission.
Mm-hmm. Sequestration, I think it's fair to say, was bad for everybody. But it was supposed to be everybody gets the same haircut. That was the design. After all the reprogramming happened, though, it kind of seems like folks who are worried about modernization primarily have shorter hair than a lot of other folks in the Army right now. Is that a fair statement?
Jared, I think that's fair. It really becomes a balance between force structure and readiness and modernization. And what we can't do today, if you take force structure out and you reduce the end strength of the Army, it takes a year or more to be able to realize those gains. So when you look to saving money and paying current bills, you look to readiness, and then you look to modernization. And certainly modernization has paid a price in terms of the Army having to pay current bills. And that's what concerns me as well, the impact on modernization of the Army going forward. Again, that's why our S&T strategy science and technology is so important going forward.
So the impacts that you saw in 13, to what extent and how quickly are those recoverable, assuming you do get some budget certainty and you do see some kind of inflow of finances here?
If we got budget certainty in, say, FY14 or 15 and beyond, FY15 and beyond, we could certainly recover from that in the out years. But it's up to the Congress, really, to solve sequestration for us. And that would really help us going forward in terms of our budget and our strategy.
So no long-term damage yet that you would point to?
No, I think we could recover in FY15 and beyond. We could certainly do that. And let me emphasize one point. No matter what our budget's going to be, we're going to do everything possible to support our soldiers and to make sure they have the right capability. We have the best trained and best equipped Army today, mm-hmm. our soldiers. If we ever allow our soldiers to go into a fight, a fair fight, then I think we failed. They always must have overmatch with the enemy. If we don't do that, then we have failed.
One of your hats is as director of the Army Acquisition Corps. Let's talk about that workforce. What have the impacts been there? I think at another AOSA event a few months ago, you said you think this has caused generational. It's going to take a generation to recover from some of the effects that we've seen on that workforce.
We have had some effects, but I will tell you, one of the priorities of the Secretary McHugh and General Odierno has always been to have adaptive Army leaders that are able to operate and manage within this complex world and within the budget realities that we've had. The dollars that we've had that we put into training, we've tried to leverage every penny that the American taxpayer has given us in order to train our acquisition workforce. There's about 41,000 of them, so they can do their jobs. And I would just add one point. We today are certified at the 95% level for all acquisition workforce members that are in the Army today. We lead the Department of Defense and all the services in terms of certification. And we've done that given the budget realities that we face today. So I'm very proud of that in my role as you just described.
Mm-hmm. And there's been so much work to build up that workforce, both in numbers and in capability. Right. On the numbers side, how are you doing? Have there been setbacks there?
Well, there's been tremendous gains made in the acquisition workforce, but the realities of what we just discussed in terms of budget uncertainties, we're going to have to bring our acquisition workforce down as the Army brings the number of soldiers that we have and the number of civilians within the Army today. The budget realities are driving us toward that. We have to do it in the most responsible way, though. And Jerry, that's so important. And that's what me and my team are struggling with today in terms of how best to do that with the budget realities that we face.
And would we expect to see that drawdown happen on both the military and the civilian side?
I believe you'll see the Army come down, obviously, in military and in civilian strength as well.
Mm-hmm. I've asked a lot of gloomy questions, and I don't want to depress people. I mean, talk with us a little bit about what you're doing to the extent you can to mitigate some of these effects and look forward and push toward that 30-year goal.
Well, what we've really tried to do is working with our partners, the Training and Doctrine Command and others within the Army staff, we've tried to focus our requirements and our resources on those capabilities that matter for our soldiers to make sure if they're going into Afghanistan or other places around the world that they have the best equipment that they can get in order to be successful on the field of battle, to execute the mission, and to come home safely to their families and their friends. I'm very proud of the job that we've done to deliver systems like MRAP, D6A that is operating in Afghanistan today, and other capabilities that our soldiers are using in combat. We've done, I think, tremendous work across the Army with our limited resources that we get to be able to accomplish that mission.
Mm-hmm. With the limited dollars that you have, is there any way in which you're prioritizing programs, systems, larger scale Army priorities going forward?
When you look at the impacts that the budget cuts and the physical reality that we face will have on modernization, we're going to take significant cuts. And Jared, as you just described, it's important that we prioritize. We have to prioritize within the various portfolios, whether it's aviation, combat vehicles. We have to make sure that we're supporting those systems that are most important and deliver the best capability for soldiers. That also requires the Army to make tough decisions. And we have tough decisions related to ground combat vehicle, armed aerial scout, and other systems that we're bringing forward because of the budget realities again.
And so would we expect to see, and you don't have to name the programs, I'm sure you can't, but would we expect to see entire programs fall off, or would we see reduced quantities, reduced buys out there, or is it impossible to generalize that way?
Jared, it could be all of the above. I mean, some of the programs that we may just have to stop. And even though we may stop them at some point, we may energize them later on when we come out of what we call the trough in terms of the budget realities and the lack of procurement dollars. Now through probably 2017, 2018, when we come out of this, we have to be prepared with our science and technology investments to be able to deliver the next capability. That's why that S&T investment that we're doing is so important, and we have to get that right and focus on the right capabilities.
Lieutenant General Bill Phillips is the Principal Military Deputy to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, and the Chief of the Army Acquisition Corps. He's one of several Army officials we were able to speak with at this year's AUSA conference here in Washington. That's our show this week. Before we go, though, I do want to say a special thanks to the Army's Office of the Chief of Public Affairs, and most especially Dave Foster. And Dave and the rest of the team put a tremendous amount of work in, as they do every year, helping us to get on the very busy schedules of the Army senior leaders, more than half a dozen of them this year, actually. All those interviews, by the way, are or very soon will be posted on federalnewsradio.com. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Jared Serdale. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu, brought to you by BAE Systems. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.